This is Radio Skid Row On Demand.
We have with us Mayor of Marrickville, Joe Halen.
Welcome to the program, Mr. Manol Tari. Kia ora, morena, Manol.
The CEO, Make-A-Wish, Gerard Menzies.
Radio Skid Row On Demand.
Radio Skid Row, 88.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Jeff Furlow and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM. The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is a weekly program for older Australians where we talk about ageing well. And every week, we'll talk about the issues that affect us as we age, right here and right now.
It happens every day.
Later in today's episode in Nostalgia Town, we'll be talking to the Honourable Michael Kirby, former Justice of the High Court of Australia and UN-appointed investigator into human rights abuses in North Korea, about his formative cultural experiences growing up just around the corner from here in Strathfield. In our last episode next week, we'll hear from Australia's own sweetheart, Little Patty, Patricia Amphlett. And before the end of the episode, we'll be speaking with Cherie Thompson, the founder and coordinator of the Inner West Women's Shed, right here in Dulwich Hill. But first things first. Today, we're going to discuss the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety with the Chief Executive Officer of the Older Persons Advocacy Network, OPAN, Craig Gear. And then my two studio guests will talk about the theme with me on the Punters panel. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this episode of the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century, where the theme is the progress of the Royal Commission into Quality and Safety in Aged Care. And my guest today is Craig Gear, who is the CEO of OPAN. That's the Older Persons Advocacy Network. Hello today to you, Craig.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me along.
Craig, can you tell us, what is OPAN?
So OPAN, the Older Persons Advocacy Network, is a member organisation of the 9 state and territory organisations that provide the National Aged Care Advocacy Program. And these guys have been doing what's termed NACAP, so that aged care advocacy, for about 25, 30 years. And we decided to come together as organisations across the country in 2017. So aged care advocacy, an aged care advocate is the person who walks beside you, helps you raise your issues, provides information, education and support so that people can stand up for their rights in relation to aged care. So it's about trying to get the most effective aged care system and get the best out of aged care system for people.
And it's quite closely linked to the Commonwealth-funded aged care services, isn't it?
Yeah, so our funding does come through the Commonwealth. So we get a grant, which is part of the Aged Care Act. And the actual Aged Care Act does actually say, look, part of funding aged care, you should fund aged care advocacy services so that people who may be more vulnerable or not have the sort of levels of access that everyone does to aged care can be supported and can have someone that can speak up for them when they need to, or give them the skills and tips and tricks to raise the issue themselves, which is what we could refer to as self-advocacy. So we're a free service, we're independent of government, and we're independent of aged care providers, which is really important.
Independence is the key.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Independence and being directed by the older person themselves. I think that's the other thing, is that we call ourselves partisan in the best way possible because we are on the side of the older person.
And this program is based in Sydney, in Marrickville. So I guess you're, for New South Wales, the organisation is the...
Seniors Rights Service, yeah. So Seniors Rights Service are based in Surry Hills. We're actually lucky enough to cohabitate with them in their offices. So I see some of the great work that the advocates here do. There's 8 advocates in New South Wales, number of about 5 of those across the region. So we've got offices in Lismore, Dubbo, Wagga, and someone on Port Macquarie, someone in the South Coast as well. And they'll take phone calls from people. So they ring our 1-800-700-600 free call number, and that gets them through to one of the advocates who can talk through some of the issues that people might have in either navigating into the aged care system, but particularly once they're in aged care, and about how to get the best out of the aged care system.
So, Craig, can you tell me, why do we have a Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety?
If I take it to the macro level, you actually have got a very big system that is supporting, depending on what types of services you look at, is about 1.3 million people who are receiving some form of aged care. And that's a lot of money going into it from the Commonwealth, and a lot of money also from people co-contributing to their aged care, whether it be at home, community support, or in residential aged care. So you get a system like that, it gets complex. And then particularly if you have trying to bring in a free market in that, so people have choice and control of the aged care, which is a really good thing. But sometimes when you do that, the systems changes are quite difficult. Also, there'd been a number of reviews around quality and safety, but there'd been, I suppose, segments of looking at the system. It hadn't been that sort of root and branch or end-to-end type look. And I suppose that's what the Royal Commission allows us to do now, is to have a proper look at the system end-to-end, look at not just the funding, but look at what people expect. The other problem is we haven't really had a conversation in Australia about what we expect from our aged care services. This is starting to shine the light on that, shining light on some bad behaviour. Luckily, it's only a small amount of bad behaviour, but that needs to be really rooted out.
You did mention some bad behaviour. It was a couple of really quite disturbing revelations that kicked off this Royal Commission.
Yeah, and a lot of those were driven by the older person or their family detecting something, and usually detecting abuse. Luckily, the figures are a little bit wobbly about the amount of abuse that goes on, but it's relatively small when you compare to the numbers of hours of aged care service that's provided. However, one case is one too many, and I think that we need to make sure that there's a system and a systemic approach that protects older people, particularly those maybe with cognitive decline, a bit of dementia, other issues that may find it harder to speak up for themselves. We need the protections in place, and we just hope that the Royal Commission does that.
So what's been revealed so far?
I have to say it's an interesting process to go through with the Royal Commission, and coming to this job wasn't something I was expecting to be involved with. And in some ways it's a real privilege to be there and actually be the voice for consumers, for older people, and to actually raise the issues, and particularly around advocacy and what's needed out there around greater availability of people to walk alongside support people, to tell their stories, to raise issues. And a number of the cases that we've heard are about issues of communication, issues of inadequate care. But for me, the most disturbing ones have been the issues around restraint, and that can be either physically tying someone or constraining them from being able to have free movement, but also what we're seeing a lot is the chemical restraint. So people given quite high strength antipsychotics and other drugs, sometimes appropriately, but other times without the proper consent and check processes in place. And that's a bit disturbing, that either staffing or other reasons have meant that people are being controlled with drugs to help control their behaviour. The government had been doing some work on that area to try and restrict or put some controls around that sort of practice. I think we're yet to see whether those controls are going to be adequate enough, because in the end, we've got a system where you've probably got general practitioners that sit slightly outside the aged care, particularly in aged care facilities, and then you've got the provider who is delivering the care and support. And there's got to be a better interface between that health and ageing system. But an over-reliance on medication to manage behaviours is just not on.
Hello, my name is Jean Kitson, and you're listening to The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century, 88.9 Radio Skid Row. Get connected and stay connected.
We're speaking with Craig Gear, the Chief Executive Officer of the Older Persons Advocacy Network, OPAN, about the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety. I asked Craig to tell us what OPAN has contributed to the Royal Commission. This is how he answered.
Yeah, so I appeared on the second day of the Royal Commission, and that was about really setting the scene of what we saw as community organisations as some of the issues and what we thought are some of the solutions. At OPAN, we're talking about a much more empowered group of, we say consumers for a reason. Consumers have rights under consumer law, and I think that older people who are in families that are in a seat of aged care need to know their rights and need to be empowered to actually stand up and exercise those rights. So that's something we talked about at the Commission. We made submission as a witness and were allowed to appear on the second day of the Royal Commission. We're also putting together a number of submissions regarding particular issues that we think are needed. Things like, how do we make sure that access is equitable for people in rural and remote areas? How do we make sure that they can still access an aged care advocate when they need to? How do we improve that health and ageing interface? And how do we make sure that there's enough home care places to meet the demand that's out there? There's sort of three really key issues that if we started to work on those, plus promoted people's rights under the Single Charter of Aged Care Rights, we'd go a long way to actually improving the aged care system.
I recall that the submission, I think, of COTA had a lot to say, concerns about the way that funding of services for older people is arranged, particularly to residential aged care facilities. Mm. Have you got anything to say about that?
The tool that is used at the moment, which is commonly referred to as the ACFI tool, A-C-F-I, and it, I suppose, had some challenges in what it was looking at. So it was looking at dependency, but not possibly in the right mechanisms. And the funding levels tied to that have been reported to be have been inadequate depending on the level of need. So the government and Professor Cathy Eager from University of Wollongong have been working on a study looking at a better resource utilisation model. And pleasingly, there's going to be a trial of that funding model. And hopefully that government will support increased funding, but in the end, increased funding only gives you good enough results if you've got the right people in place. This is about really having staff with the right attitude, with the right training, and being in the right place at the right time. If you don't have those sorts of things in place, or if you're putting the wrong types of staff with the wrong attitude in place, you still have problems with the system. Funding is only one part of the answer.
So culture is a matter as well, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. And culture comes from the top, comes from the board of the organisation that's providing the care and support. It also comes from that frontline manager. So the care centre manager is so vital in this because they'll set the culture and the tone. It's that stuff that's spoken about, the behaviour that you walk past is the behaviour you tolerate, and you do see that sometimes where busyness or lack of training or whatever allows things to slip by. We can't have that anymore. And investing in that culture and that management to have a really environment that celebrates the staff, because they do a really good job, but they need to be supported.
So, Craig Gere, what happens next?
So that's the interesting thing. We're waiting on a decision around, I suppose, the interim report and what will be contained in the interim report. That's meant to be handed down by the Royal Commission in October. Their final report at this stage is meant to be in April, and that's a really short time. I don't think we've had a Royal Commission that's kind of dealt with something so complex as this and so quickly. So I'm hoping that the Royal Commission will be allowed the time to ponder these things appropriately and to come up with solutions that are actually going to work, and really to listen to the aged care sector, the consumer groups, the community organisations, not-for-profits, the unions, the service providers themselves, and the health professional groups. Because if you can listen to all of those, I think we can come up with solutions, but then it's not the time for Band-Aids. We need something that's actually going to make a difference.
So I suppose it's not just a matter of the conclusions of the Royal Commission, it's what happens afterwards, the implementation, the changes in policy and law.
Absolutely, and while some aged care reform has been continuing on, which is great, and we want to see more of that, we're really supportive of that, we actually do need to have a conversation in Australia around ageism, and also about what we expect out of our aged care system, how much we expect to contribute ourselves, what's realistic, but the level of care and support that we expect and need, and the choice and control that we want in that aged care system. They're the conversations I think need to start to happen once we start having some of the interim reports handed down to actually say, well, what do we want this system to be 10, 15, 20 years into the future? What do we have to do now to get that system?
And we have an ageing population, so we better pull our fingers out.
Sustainability is going to be a big issue. This stuff costs, yeah, and we've got to work out a way that we can sustain the aged care system. All of us will probably use it to some level at some stage in our life if we're lucky. It's a good thing that we can use it.
Craig, do you have any final messages to the listeners of this program about OPAN and the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety?
Good news is that we've actually been given a very small amount of money, but some money anyway, to help people tell their stories. So we have on our website at opan.com.au the details of our callback service to help people to tell their stories and put a submission into the Royal Commission. And the other thing I'd say is that we're always here to provide information, education and assistance if people have got concerns about their aged care or the aged care someone else might be receiving, or even someone might be at risk of abuse from someone, be it financial, family member, psychological, whatever. And our advocates are there to help. So they're available 8 to 8, Monday to Friday, on 1800 700 600. And I've encouraged people to pass that number around if they think they know someone who might need a bit of support.
And we'll have to post those links on the website when the time comes to put this interview onto the internet. I want to thank you very much, Craig Gear, for speaking to us today on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.
More than welcome. Thanks, Jeff.
And now it's time for the Punters Panel, where we speak with local older people about the issue of the day. And in the studio today, I have Lucille McKenna and Jude Stoddart, who've joined us again to talk about the Royal Commission into Aged Care Safety and Quality. And, of course, when we're talking about aged care, we're talking about quite some challenges, aren't we? What do you have experience dealing with ageing yourself, Jude?
Well, I have experience dealing with ageing in myself, not quite what you meant, I think. Yes, actually, sadly, I do in a way, because it was actually happened to me in my late 20s, early 30s, that my mother had a massive stroke, left her paralysed down one side and unable to find words. And the thing for me was the frightening nature of, you know, leaving my mother in an institution where she seemed unable to speak up for herself. And I found it a real challenge, both finding sufficient care for her when she came out of that institution and for my father, because he also got sick. So, I was quite skilled in negotiating systems at the time, and I had trained as a young social worker. So you'd thought I would know my way around. But actually, I found the pressure of trying to organise something and also to get them to accept the care, they were real challenges. So it's not only the initial issue of being in the hospital, but also then how do you follow up and how do you help people live a satisfactory life when they need support?
Yes, it's a real challenge. I mean, as you know, I worked in aged care for many years, and but when it comes to yourself, I found those challenges exactly as you have with my mum. She had many years in a nursing home because she had dementia, and it was a real challenge to actually leave her each day, even though she was in the nursing home that I was running. So. It's so important, though, that the culture is right in these places. It really is about how do they get treated, where people have empathy and where people are very caring. And, you know, you can actually gauge a lot of this the minute you walk into a residential place.
Absolutely.
The way people are speaking to them, each other, between the staff, between towards the residents or patients, you can actually feel it. But of course, the bigger there's another group as well now. It's not just residential carers. There's so many people are being cared for in their homes, and so we have to be concerned about how they're being looked after and whether they're getting good continuity of care or not. You know, changing staff and new people coming into their homes all the time, and the fear that older people have about people in their homes, and there's all sorts of issues with that. So again, we need really skilled people with that empathy.
I think your points about culture are absolutely, and nothing excuses bad behaviour. Nothing excuses some of the treatment we've seen on the videos recent days. But the one of the things I think really is important to think about in terms of culture is what's the structure of the industry we're talking about.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns for me is that we've got an increasingly privatised and corporatised industry behind aged care. Mm. So we've got people making millions and millions, billions, in fact, with the Ramsay Foundation, for example, billions, not the foundation, the healthcare unit, making a lot of money. And that's money that's going out of our system, not going into our system. If it goes out in profit, then it's not being recycled within the system. So I think we need to talk a bit about the structure of care as well and the structure of that industry.
Well, the structure is it's really quite sad because, as you've just mentioned, Ramsay, one of the biggest aged care providers is Bupa, and they've certainly don't look too good in the Royal Commission. But these organisations are they're corporations, and the money, well, in the sense of Bupa, I think theirs goes to England. It's certainly not money staying here, but the issue really is that they have to make a profit for their shareholders. I don't really understand how you can be providing the best service and giving the best care to your residents in your homes when decisions are being made in boardrooms and in these corporate management rooms about what will happen in these places. And when things get tight, it's always the staffing that is dumbed down, whether it's less hours or less people or whatever. It just creates this cycle of trying to squeeze more profit out of these organisations. And this is a fairly new phenomena for Australia. We didn't have these. Corporations couldn't own an aged care facility until the 96 when the Aged Care Act was implemented by the Howard government. And it was bipartisan at the time, but it certainly has proven to be a real problem. Mm. We've seen the number of registered nurses working in aged care dropped by 50% since those days or more untrained people. Also, the other issue that goes with the culture, I think, is leadership. So you need people who really care at the top. They've got to look after their staff so they can look after their residents or their patients.
And I think, I would agree with you that pressure down on reducing your staff in quantity and quality is a real concern within the industry because, you know, it can't be seen as just a few bad apples. We've got to think about, well, is this the best structure for our industry and for the sort of care that we really want to give? And I thought a very important point that somebody made the other day was that we're talking about a rethink now, and it's really important that we get that right. It's going to take a number of years to implement these reforms, and you know, some of us will sadly not be here to see them probably, but in a way we've got to engage the next generation, the younger generation, in talking about the sorts of reforms that we need to have, because they will be the ones that are moving into those homes and getting that care. So we need some really serious long-term planning where the main driver is not the profit motive. It's recognising that we need to treat our people humanly and decently.
Yes, exactly.
Right into their eventual death.
There have been so many inquiries into aged care over the last 10 or 15 years. I've given evidence to at least three upper house inquiries. The pricing, what's it called?
The Productivity Commission.
Productivity Commission.
Yeah.
We've had many. If I sat down, I could probably find 15 or 20 inquiries. This is an opportunity for this real root and branch look at this industry. I just hope they've left enough time, because the submissions can continue. They're still accepting submissions. I think it's October that we have the interim report, and then sometime mid next year. So I just hope that they're able to really get a proper handle across these things and really address the issues, to make sure that places are run properly. And as businesses, I don't really know, and for someone who's been part of the industry, my mind boggles at the thought of how this is going to be dealt with.
Yes, one of the things that our speaker, Craig, spoke about was, I appreciate he has to be also very careful, but he talked about the move towards marketisation being at least giving people choice. But I think there's a lot of myths about choice at the moment, because actually to have real choice, first of all, you have to have really good independent information. And easy access to that information to understand the full range of services that are available, say for your loved one or whatever. And secondly, you also really need to have effective power in a private market to buy.
Yeah.
And people don't have the sorts of sums of money that now is required to enter into, halfway care, in the sense of sort of retirement homes or those sorts of things. The costs are just disproportionate for people. And I think we have to be really careful when we say, well, there's a real benefit to this because it brings us choice. Choice has to be effective choice. You have to be able to really make those choices. But we're not talking about situations where people have that sort of access to either information or access to endless resources to buy in the options they might want.
Well, of course, a lot of the people that are going into a residential situation can't really make that choice themselves. Many of them can't, either because of some sort of disability or dementia. 50% of people that enter aged care have dementia. So they need really strong advocates, and some people have them, others don't. So there's also some real issues about the way the system is structured in relation to costs, because it should be available to everybody, basically the same service. But unfortunately, some of the private proprietors seem to be actually not telling people the whole truth, so that they actually don't realise that they actually don't have to pay these large amounts of money. So,
and I'm going to have to thank you both, Lucille and Jude, for contributing today on the Punters Panel. For the segment of the show that we call Nostalgia Town, where we talk to well-known older Australians about the musical, the theatrical and the film experiences that helped make them the people they are today.
You must remember this, a kiss is still a kiss.
The Honourable Michael Kirby is a past Justice of the High Court of Australia. In May 2013, he was appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council to lead an inquiry into human rights abuses in North Korea, which reported in February 2014. Welcome today to Nostalgia Town, Michael Kirby.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, what were the formative cultural experiences you grew up with? What were your favourite songs, your movies, film, other stuff that affected you?
Well, when when I was young, I was sent to get me out of my parents' hair to the Odeon Theatre at Concord West in Sydney, and occasionally to the Melba Theatre at Strathfield. Both of those have been pulled down since then, unfortunately. But Hollywood and Batman, Hopalong Cassidy and all those sorts of things were a regular fare on a Saturday. My father loved Noel Coward, so we had lots of Noel Coward records. He also enjoyed the singing of Dame Joan Hammond, who was the predecessor to Dame Joan Sutherland and Joan Carden. Seems all great Australian sopranos were Joan. Joan Hammond sang opera, but usually in English, and it made it very accessible. So we had musical comedy at the Tivoli. We had Joan Hammond on the records, and it was Saturday afternoon at the local cinema.
And you're talking about things like Batman and Hopalong Cassidy. They were the serials, weren't they, at the movies?
Well, I think they've gone back to Batman. I believe everybody is now looking at Batman, and they're looking at Captain Marvel. All those things of my youth are coming back, and a good thing too, because that was good, wholesome stuff.
I would have thought that reading comic books in your dad's garage might have been, a little trivial. But not for you.
Well, everybody needs a little bit of trivia in life, I'm afraid. You can't be absorbed in the Encyclopedia Britannica or now Wikipedia all the time. But we had quite a lot of classical music, wonderful recordings of Josef Schmidt. He was a tenor in Germany, but he was Jewish, and he suffered as a result of that and was banished from Germany, and he died soon afterwards. This is in the post-war era, and it had been a pretty grim time with the war and the suffering and the discovery of the Holocaust, and therefore it needed a little lightening up on a Saturday afternoon.
You did mention the Hollywood music, Hollywood movies, and perhaps Hollywood musicals had a bit of an influence on you too.
Yes, well, I went to the cinema, as I've said, and I think I was doled out ninepence. If you went upstairs, you had to pay the whole ninepence for the admission. So I would pay sixpence, go downstairs, no velvet seats. These were vinyl seats and lino on the floor. And I would cheer the heroes of the screen, who were basically American imports, as most people get today. So it was Captain Marvel, Batman and Robin, and Hopalong Cassidy, and Gene Autry. He was another star of the Saturday afternoon cowboy films.
A previous guest on the program was John Bell, and he did make a point about how it did seem that as he was growing up that particularly film was imported, and he spoke about the cultural cringe, in particular with the wonderful Summer of the 17th Doll being made with American actors. Did that affect you at all, that cultural cringe?
Well, I think all Australians felt at that time that they were part of the glorious British Empire. I mean, we're talking about just after the war. We'd just survived the war. We'd just won another war. We were rather proud of that effort, and it was a good war to win, if I can say so. But being British, it's hard to explain it now to young Australians, but we felt we were part of a big world family of English-speaking countries, and the King was the head of it, and that was just how it had been for a long while, and that was how we expected it would stay forever. But very soon the exhaustion of the war and the loss of blood and treasure led to independence to many countries, and even Australia eventually became more independent-minded. But there were movies and actors. Chips Rafferty was a well-known Australian actor, and he appeared in movies immediately after the war. But it's true, as John Bell has said, there weren't many of them. But we didn't really, I don't think we would have thought of it at the time as a cringe. We would have thought, well, here we are down in the South Seas. We are part of the family of British nations, and we contribute our few, but most of the tops of the pops were from Hollywood, or increasingly in those days, British actors and actresses, and there was a particular cinema in Sydney CBD, the Embassy in Castlereagh Street, that only showed British films. And being a very loyal sort of a chap, that was the place I would normally go to and see the British films, because they seem to be more serious than the lightweight Hollywood fare that was served up in most of the cinemas.
Do you suppose that the Australian cinema tradition is more influenced by the English one than the American one?
I would have said that back in the time of my childhood, but with television came the swamping of Australian culture by so many of the old black and white movies and regular features, soap operas, Bilko and Hawaiian Eye and Boyd QC. Well, that was an English show, but there were so many films imported that you saw yourself through the prism of other English-speaking countries. Not too many foreign films. There was a cinema in Bligh Street, the Paris, and it used to have imported films from Scandinavia, Ingmar Bergman films and French language films, but overwhelmingly it was English-speaking films from countries other than Australia, mostly American, but some are from the United Kingdom.
And was radio a part of your life growing up?
Oh, very much so, yes. We were addicted to the Argonauts on the ABC. I was never myself an Argonaut, but I used to listen to the serials that were such a feature of those times. I remember one of them was about the capture of whales in the Antarctic. And, of course, in those days, we were on the side of the whalers. But nowadays, that's very politically incorrect. We've all got to be on the side of the whales. But not too many of the children of my time were on the side of the whales. The whales were big monsters that you had to harpoon, drag in and slaughter. But the radio was the means of majority communication. Later on, we were allowed to switch to 2GB. And on Sunday nights, we'd hear hymns from all churches. This was a time when Australia was much more religious than it is now. And you'd listen to the hymns sung. I still like to hear hymns played and sung. And maybe that will come back at some time. But on the radio station, there was John Deese, and he had a program called World Famous Tenors. I think that was on a Sunday night too, and we would listen to the famous tenors. It was introduced by a song sung by Jussi Björling, the Scandinavian tenor. This was None Shall Sleep from Turandot by Puccini. So we got a good serving in my home of classics, not heavy classics. I mean, a Bach cello concerto didn't appear very often. I believe Barry Jones has nominated a few of those, and I came to that music later on in time. But at the time I was growing up, it was generally a bit lighter than that, and recordings of famous singers. And we all loved Joan Hammond. She had a wonderful voice, and in fact, later I got to know her, and my partner and I had lunch with her and her partner at the Royal Sydney Golf Club. She was a great golfer, but she had a magnificent voice, a sort of a mezzo type of soprano, but a very great opera singer.
Michael Kirby, you're 80 now. And
did you have to mention that on a public audience? Oh, I'd like people to think I may be about 60.
Maybe I can edit it out, but you know, this show is meant to remind us that aging can be fun. And I want to ask you, do you think can aging be fun? What are the benefits of aging?
Well, to be honest, I don't think of myself as an old fogey, and I'm still extremely busy, and I'm flat out with conferences. I got back on Tuesday of this week from Budapest, where I was chairing the Human Rights Institute of the International Bar Association, looking at worldwide problems of human rights. And I went yesterday, immediately after, to Melbourne, talked on the National Diversity Council of Australia on the issues of human rights in our own country. And next week I have to go to a session in Melbourne for a mediation, a big dispute between parties, which I'll try to help them to resolve. So there's plenty going on. I think life can be fun so long as you've got your health and especially your mental capacities, and that is largely a matter of chance. But your basic musical tastes and your tastes in literature are laid down by your parents at a very early age, and you just got to be lucky in that department. My father bought us records of Shakespeare, and so we experienced Shakespeare on record. Maybe John Bell also had this, not as a heavy book to be read, but as the dramatic, vivid dramas of Julius Caesar or Richard III or the wonderful language of William Shakespeare. So you've got to be lucky with your parents. If they give you a good diet and a mixed diet, you can be eclectic, and that cultural experience can follow you all your life. And we shouldn't be too narrow in Australia, you know, saying, oh, cultural cringe, we've got to have everything Australian. We are part of an international language and an international culture, and we've got to make our own contributions, but we've got to be proud that we share this with about a quarter of humanity, and it's a wonderful thing that we do.
Do you value, Michael Kirby, your social connections? How important are they to you?
Well, in my life, the longest and closest is that with my partner, now my spouse, Johan. 50 years is this poor man has put up with me, and it's a great blessing in my life, and it's a good thing that I've lived long enough to have been able to marry him, and that was by the vote of the Australian people, and it shows that you can make progress in society. I don't have all that much time for social connections if you're thinking of going to the local pub and putting your elbow on the bar and talking for hours. I just don't have the time for that. I'm too busy with my work and getting on with efforts in the United Nations and in other bodies to deal with the world. Do I value those connections? I certainly do. Do I think that they are important? Well, they're not world-shattering, but everybody has to make their contribution, if they can, to improving the world, make it a better place for the future, because there's certainly many wrongs that have to be righted, and we must never accept wrongs. We have to stand up against wrongs.
I want to thank you very much, Honourable Michael Kirby, former Justice of the High Court of Australia, for joining us today on Nostalgia Town.
Thank you for having me. I'll come back any time. Talk about my very happy childhood. It brings back memories of my parents, wonderful parents, my grandmother and my brothers and sister. Wonderful time in my life.
And now on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century, it's time for Out and About, where we find out about some of the things that older people can do in Sydney and in the inner west. The economy is down and your mind is unsound and your body's an empty shell. Good afternoon, listeners. Our guest today on Out and About is Cherie Thompson, who is the founder of the Inner West Women's Shed based out at Dulwich Hill. How are you today, Cherie?
Good, thank you, Geoffrey.
So, Cherie, what is Women's Shed and how did it start?
Okay, the Women's Shed, we meet at Dulwich Hill in the Seaview Hall in Seaview Street. There's council parking at both ends of that street, free council parking, and it's quite easy to get there by bus. Every Wednesday, we meet there from 12 to 4, and we unleash our creative selves and we have a cuppa and we have a chat. We occasionally have a speaker who will come along. We're waiting to have somebody come and talk to us about stroke. And we've just recently had a financial advisor come along and talk to us about the differences and the problems with ageing and getting a place. It started about 6 years ago. I was a volunteer on the then Marrickville Council Seniors Reference Group. and I heard a conversation about men's shed, and I piped up and said, why isn't there a women's shed? Well, they put a small article in the Courier, and we held a meeting, and 45 women turned up, and the Inner West Women's Shed was born. And so we've been going for almost 6 years. We've got a good core group of about 25, but we have a good membership of about 50. We're a quite shy, retiring little group. All the women have other interests. They have part-time jobs, or they have a parent or a partner that they're looking after. So you don't see the same people each week. We have some other groups that we fundraise for, and we have activities going on throughout the year. We have an annual art exhibition. We've got a Mother's Day stall coming up, which will be down at the Addison Road Community Centre on the Sunday, the 5th of May, from 9 till 2. And we're all beavering away making lovely handmade goods that'll be for sale down there. We have an annual Christmas stall every year, which is highly successful. And then the funds that we raise from that, they go to a local women's refuge. It's the Aboriginal Women's and Children's Crisis Service. They've been going for, I think, 25 or 30 years. And so we support them as best we can. We give them Kmart vouchers. We run a coat drive every year.
And how old are the people who turn up?
You can't ask those personal questions, Jess. Varying ages. Ages from... We have some people who, during the school holidays, might bring their granddaughter. So you could have somebody there from 12 to 80. Women of all ages are welcome. All ages and all cultures.
So how can people find out more and join in?
We don't give out a phone number because we only meet once a week and we aren't a business. We did find in the beginning that if you had a phone number, there would be a never-ending list of phone calls of ladies asking, what do you do there? It changes so frequently. So we have a really good Facebook page, and I know a lot of people are a bit iffy about Facebook, but if you just want to go on and check and see what we're doing. We take photos every week. Photos of the projects that we're working on will be available to see there. Or what else we say is pop along for a cuppa and a chat and a laugh and see if we are what you're looking for. And that has worked for 6 years. It's worked really well.
We're going to have to make sure that we'll put links to your Facebook page on the website for the Baby Boomers Guide.
That would be really good, yes, please. And we're also having somebody coming over and giving hearing tests. We cover everything. We've done decluttering workshop. If anyone doesn't want to use the Facebook link, you can pay your membership, which is only $10 a year. And that also entitles you to a 10% discount at many of the local retailers, only on full-priced items, not on specials. And then we can add you to the mailing list, so you'd receive an email each week about what's coming up for the following week.
Are you finding that you're making contact with people who may otherwise be a bit lonely or isolated?
Oh, well, I think everybody is. Everybody's looking for something to do. We're a creative social group. We're not a support group. We do give a lot of support, and a lot of friendships have been formed. We have recently this year, at the beginning of the year, we had two ladies who happened to turn up on the same day, and they'd heard about us. They were both coming from Enmore. Anyway, they both left individually, and just so happened they got on the bus. And there they were both on the bus. And when the bus got to a certain stop, they both got off at the same stop. And lo and behold, they live right near each other. And so now we've got a great friendship happening. One doesn't like to drive, so the other one now drives. They're just a fabulous pair of middle-aged women who have found a great friendship, and that has happened over and over again during the 6 years that we've been going. We have a woman who we call the knitting doctor, and she can solve every knitting problem that you've ever, 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 any woman has ever had. And she's always there and available to solve the knitting problems. And we also have a lot of women who bring along the UFOs. UFOs, in craft terms, are unfinished objects. And I'm sure any woman who's got knitting or who's knitted or sewn or embroidered or done something, she's always got something in the back of that cupboard that didn't just quite get finished. and you'll see a row of ladies will be sitting there, and they'll all be UFOing.
I suppose if you're a woman living in the Inner West, an older woman, and you're looking for something to do, people to meet, then the way to get into contact with you is to just drop in at the Seaview Hall.
Yes.
But you can also be checked out on the Facebook page. Yes. Tell me, what's the name of your Facebook page?
Inner West Women's Shed, Inc. We're an incorporated group. We have directors, and we're a not-for-profit. So we're a legit group. And as I said, membership is only $10 a year. Just recently, the local community transport are going to be running a service where they will pick up and deliver ladies who want to come to the Inner West Shed. As long as you're eligible, if you keep in touch with us, we'll be able to let you know when that starts.
I want to thank you, Cherie Thompson, the founder of the Inner West Women's Shed.
Thank you, Jeff. Bye, everybody.
The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is produced in the studios of Radio Skid Row. You can hear this show again weekly on Thursdays at 3 o'clock, or you can listen again online by searching for Radio Skid Row, and you'll find a link in the SoundCloud box to the right. Join us again in a week's time for the next episode, and don't forget to check us out online by going to www.radioskidrow.org and following the links. This production was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. This program is produced with the assistance of Lex Marinos and Raul Hernandez. I'm your host, Jeff Forlow, and I hope you can join us again next week.